Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We told you last week after Iowa, it was difficult to make it make sense for Ron DeSantis to stay in this race, despite announcing on caucus night that Iowa had punched his ticket to the next round. Not really. And ultimately, yesterday, after several days of reflection, Ron DeSantis' campaign concluded the same thing. He posted this announcement, which at the outset of it sounded like he was re-announcing for president.
Citizens do not serve politicians. It is the duty of politicians to serve you. Talk is cheap. Actions speak louder than words. Reversing the decline of this nation requires leadership that delivers big results for the people we are elected to serve. I have a record of leading with conviction, championing an agenda marked by bold colors, delivering on my promises, and defeating the people who are responsible for our nation's decline. That is the type of leadership we need for all of America.
But
if there was anything I could do to produce a favorable outcome, more campaign stops, more interviews, I would do it. But I can't ask our supporters to volunteer their time and donate their resources if we don't have a clear path to victory. Accordingly, I am today suspending my campaign.
Don't do it. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA and then a quick comment. The one thing that he said there, Dan, that didn't sit well with me was him saying, if I could have done more interviews, you had a lot of chances to be like Vivek, to be like Trump, to go on podcasts, to go on CNN at the beginning of his campaign, and he wouldn't do it. So I don't know.
That was one of the missteps in his campaign. Reflecting on Ron DeSantis' campaign, and really it is something to study because in December of 2022, I mean, there were some polls that had him up on Trump in the wake of those disappointing midterm elections. So it is a pretty significant fall from grace, failure to launch. Pick the cliche that you prefer. The other thing, too, is these, the Trump indictments. Trump was indicted once before Ron DeSantis announced, and it was clear he was going to be indicted
three more times,
at least a couple more times. And so that was something that Ron DeSantis and his campaign had to have factored in. So you can't say, well, it would have been, except he was blindsided by the indictments, because the timeline doesn't support that argument. Through your reviews on DeSantis, and while you're thinking about what transpired over the last year with his campaign, Ron DeSantis, in that same announcement that he was getting out through his support to Trump.
It's clear to me that a majority of Republican primary voters want to give Donald Trump another chance. They watch his presidency get stymied by relentless resistance, and they see Democrats using lawfare this day to attack him. Well, I've had disagreements with Donald Trump, such as on the coronavirus pandemic and his elevation of Anthony Fauci. Trump is superior to the current incumbent, Joe Biden. That is clear. I signed a pledge to support the Republican nominee, and I will honor that pledge. He has my endorsement because we can't go back to the old Republican guard of yesteryear, a repackage formed of warmed-over corporatism that Nikki Haley represents. The days of putting Americans last, of kowtowing to large corporations, of caving to woke ideology are over.
And Trump, once he got word in New Hampshire that DeSantis had made it official, he was gracious. He was at a campaign headquarters in Concord before he did a rally. And he was asked about the Ron DeSanctimonious nickname.
Yeah.
Okay. He just said, will I be using the name Ron DeSanctimonious? I said, that name is officially retired.
And Meathead, too. Remember he called him, or Meatball? Meathead.
And at that rally, it was in Rochester, he was in Concord, I think, the day before. The campaign office and rally, campaign office in Rochester there. And then at the rally in Rochester, speaking to the larger faithful, he said this about DeSantis.
Before we begin, I'd like to take time to congratulate Ron DeSantis and, of course, a really terrific person who had gotten to know his wife, Casey, for having run a great campaign for president. He did. He ran a really good campaign, I will tell you.
Didn't.
It's not easy. What? They think it's easy doing this stuff, right? It's not easy. But as you know, he left the campaign trail today at 3 p.m., and in so doing, he was very gracious, and he endorsed me, so I appreciate it. I appreciate that, and I also look forward to working with Ron and everybody else to defeat Crooked Joe Biden. We will have to get him out. We have to get him out. He's put our country at great peril. At great peril. So I just want to thank Ron and congratulate him on doing a very good job. It's a tough situation. It's a tough thing to do.
You know, DeSantis was gracious and did the right thing, something we suggested was the obvious thing for him to do while there's still a window of opportunity where it would benefit him. And Trump was gracious in return, because why wouldn't you be?
Right. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. I will tell you this. I'm surprised that some people are that it took so long. In Iowa, they spent $130 million and got 21,000 votes. That's it. He had people, and he went to 99 counties, didn't win one. Nikki Haley won Johnson County by one vote. That's where University of Iowa is. But they knocked on 812,000 doors. And in Iowa, when he came in second place, he didn't thank any of the hundreds of volunteers that came from all over the country to help him out in Iowa. I thought that was kind of classless. But he did thank them yesterday in his, you know, I'm suspending my campaign speech.
Well, this race is over, and it'll officially be over tomorrow after Trump wins the New Hampshire primary, and we can all move on and focus on the matchup that is in the general. Greg and Schomburg, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning, Dan and Amy. You know, the point that Amy just brought up is going to be the point I'm going to pick up on as I put this point on first. Before he opened his mouth yesterday when I saw him on my YouTube, I thought, wow, he looks like Howdy Doody. It's that big plastic one-dimensional smile where he's going to go fact, 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 fact. And he's going to then, you know, totally miss the emotion of the moment, not be real, not talk about all the people that were involved. And Amy, the fact that you just brought that up, that really substantiates exactly what I think is the deficit in his DeSantis personality, that he better had learned, he better get some speechwriters involved that can do the Bill Clinton thing, which is the ability to realize when you're in politics, you're dealing with people, you're connecting with their emotions, and you're transporting their emotions to a higher level of actualization for the world.
Yeah, it's called charisma.
Thanks,
and he didn't
call,
have
Greg.
Any. I mean, and his comms team, my God, they weren't even able to get him to New Hampshire. I thought for sure he'd last even maybe to Super Tuesday at the beginning of this. But now, I mean, my God, that's, you know, I think they have some egg in their face, don't you?
So I think Greg's point about DeSantis being sort of wooden. I mean, you heard it in that 4.5 minute exit speech. It's just like it was perfunctory. It's a run through the cliches. Thank the volunteers. We did our best. This is the reason we got into the race. This is the reason we're getting out. I'm going to do the right thing here and support Trump, because mainly it's in my own interest to do that. But there is nothing that you grab onto. I mean, he spent most of the campaign, particularly in the early days, running around telling everybody what he did in Florida. And that's fine because he's got a record and it's right. a good one and he should run on it. But there was never that connection to what I did in Florida and how I am going to sort of scale that that nationally. I mean, he had plans and he had bullet points and I'm going to take this to D.C. and I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. There's never sort of the more fulsome development of Ron DeSantis. Like, look, let me tell you about when I was in Congress.
Yeah. Yes, to remind people, because people forget that he even served our country.
And let me tell you something important about my time in Congress and what I learned. And let me tell you something important about my time as governor of Florida and what I've learned and in this environment. And so when I say I'm going to do this because I've done this, let me tell you a story or give you an insight that animates what I've done and what I plan to do. There's no animation around DeSantis. You feel like you're listening to somebody recite bullet points, and it just is not particularly compelling. He never had the big vision thing. He never had the understandable value proposition, sort of the one sentence why that people could grab onto, so then they would listen to the what and the how. And the other thing he made, I mean, his campaign was awful. That, I mean, I like Ken Cuccinelli, but that Never Back Down Super PAC did an awful job. Jeff Rowe, who finally was ousted. I mean, I'm getting into the weeds here.
Yeah,
but, you know, this consultant baseball class did DeSantis wrong. And ultimately, that's on him because a lot of people told him that certain people would do him wrong and he didn't listen. A lot of people told him this isn't the time for you and he didn't listen too. That's more understandable. But some of the personnel choices he made, how long they lasted, the work product was just not good. And the other mistake they made, which is what a lot of these consultants, including the quote unquote conservative Republican consultants, do, is they want to sidle up to the mainstream media because they're looking at DeSantis as a payday. They're looking at DeSantis, what job could I get if he won? But they're also looking ahead and, this is an opportunity for me to be a big shot because I'm on one of the premier campaigns at the presidential level. And so I'm going to make my relationships with the D.C. press corps and I'm going to give them access so we become friends because I can use that later on for my other clients or to get other clients. This is what you have to understand about the mindset. And it's surprising to me that Ron DeSantis didn't, as somebody who keeps his counsel, that he was led astray. And let me give you an example of this because it happened over the weekend.
What is it?
This noxious NBC reporter, Dasha Burns.
Oh.
So clearly the Never Back Down staff had given the D.C. press corps access to the campaign, right? Hey, yeah, we're getting pub and access to the campaign. Look what we're doing. Right. You let the
fox in the hen house.
Basically. And this is what happens at the end.
Well, look, over the course of covering this campaign, there are many stories that kind of explain why he failed to really get off the ground in the way that a lot of people expected him to. But one of those stories came to us in the final days of the Iowa caucus, and it has to do with a puzzle. Now, stay with me here. Multiple staffers from the headquarters of the DeSantis Iowa operation, their field operation run by Never Back Down, reached out to me and my producer, Abby Brooks, and said that the CEO and chairman of that organization was spending a significant amount of time in those final critical days working on a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle. Now, some of those staffers were so confused and found it so absurd that one of them actually took a photo of it and shared it with us. And the frustration was described to me from one of them saying that, you know, look, staffers are putting their dedication and devotion to electing Governor DeSantis. And they come in and the CEO and chairman of the organization is sitting there working on a puzzle for hours. Now, in a comment to NBC News, Scott Wagner, the gentleman in the picture there, tells us that it was an office puzzle. He said that it was there when they arrived and became a sense of pride for team members, and everyone chipped in a few minutes to get it done and noted his pride of the team.
Yeah, good look, Scott Wagner. And this is what you get when you say, yeah, let's invite Dasha Burns in and let's get our exposure and let's develop that relationship. And then the end of it is you get everybody assembled at the NBC, in quotes, news desk giggling about you. Well played. Indicative of the DeSantis campaign on the talent side, on the consultant and campaign execution side. That was a big problem, too.
And that's why it's over.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So over the weekend, in advance of DeSantis's departure, what you saw was really a consolidation of conservative, reform-minded Republicans with some profile behind Trump. I mean, they're really starting to see the buildup of even some establishment support of Trump, because the outcome of this primary campaign is not in doubt, which is why I don't see Nikki Haley putting up much of a fight in New Hampshire tomorrow. Maybe she's within a stone's throw, about what the polling says, 10, 12, 15 points. But I think Trump wins tomorrow, and that effectively concludes this portion of the program.
Well, there are some Nikki Haley supporters out there that listen to this show, and she was very excited yesterday to hear the news.
We just heard that Ron DeSantis has dropped out of the race.
Using single digits.
And I want to say to Ron, he ran a great race. He's been a good governor, and we wish him well. Having said that, it's now one fella and one lady left.
Whatever. I mean, that's that's a good example of what I'm talking about with Nikki Haley. I mean, my interaction with her, I did a sit-down interview with her when her book came out a couple years back in Naperville, in front of a live audience, and she was perfectly pleasant, and we had a nice conversation, a nice time. But she's not any more dynamic a candidate than Ron DeSantis is. She's a cliche machine. She has nothing important to say. She has nothing even interesting to say. She can't figure out whether she wants to play identitarian politics or she doesn't want to play identitarian politics. Right. This is going nowhere. So, I mean, believe whatever you want to believe, and then tomorrow will bear out the situation. I mean, Governor McMaster from South Carolina headed up to New Hampshire to endorse Trump ahead of South Carolina's primary. As I said on Friday, you look at, she's within striking distance of Trump, but then you look below the fold. Among Republicans, self-identified Republicans in New Hampshire, Trump is up 40. So the only thing that is making this even interesting in New Hampshire are independents and Democrats, which are not going to be a vote in many primaries after New Hampshire, which says New Hampshire, I mean, it almost doesn't matter. It just matters in terms of, does it end immediately after New Hampshire, or do we have to go on and pretend like this is a contest for a couple of more elections? That's the only thing that's really at stake here. Speaking of South Carolina, the endorsement I was referring to is, of course, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, who, after endorsing Trump, was one of those surrogates out on the Sunday talkies making the case for Trump and against Biden. And Scott, you know, he's a nice guy. He needs to get a little sharper in these exchanges, I think, but I think he's good. And I'm a fan of the idea of Tim Scott being Trump's running mate. Here he was on CNN over the weekend responding to Dana Bash's pathetic attempt to try to impose grievance politics as the calling card of Trump, as opposed to the calling card of the entire Democrat Socialist Party and its comm shop, which includes Dana Bash.
And for a person who's seen the DOJ weaponized against him, for a person who, before he was ever sworn into office, the Washington Post said they were going to make sure that he is a one-term president. When you look at the challenges that he faced, there's no doubt that he has been aggrieved. The question is, what are the American voters looking for? Here's what they're looking for. They are looking for a president who represents their best future and not his. That president is not Joe Biden. It is Donald Trump.
But here's something else from Scott. I thought this is bringing this back. I mean, we've been very focused on the situation at the border and how it has metastasized into big cities in America. And Scott, you know, wanted to bring it back to something that is granular, that has been with us for the last 3 years, has not gone away. It's only been exacerbated by the political leadership in big blue states and big blue cities. And that's also spread, though. That's also metastasized into suburban communities. And this is where there is opportunity politically. Talking just about violent crime. Also, this intersects, of course, with the influx of people from around the world, most of whom we know very little about, and the incidence of crime, increased crime among that cohort that we've seen.
When you look around the cities, when you grow up in poor communities like I did, and you watch the crime ravishing your communities, you ask yourself, what president has allowed that to happen? It's Joe Biden. When you have DAs around the country that says it's no longer a crime to steal $1,000 worth of goods, and those stores start closing in San Francisco and across the country, you ask yourself, What president allowed that lawless behavior to continue? That's Joe Biden. You ask yourself, who can restore
Senator,
the kind of law and order in our nation to allow it to go forward? That would be Donald Trump.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Specifically, Scott for VP, and we'll get people's reaction to that, because that would be my leader in the clubhouse right now.
Well, I think what solidified it was this morning when I woke up to see his tweet. Dan, she said yes. Mindy, thank you for making me the luckiest man in the world. Quote, he who finds a wife finds what is good and receives favor from the Lord. Proverbs 18:22. Tim Scott got engaged over the weekend to his girlfriend, Mindy. And to me, that solidified that he is definitely the VP pick.
He said, she said, yes. I said, man down.
And Dan, that makes you all alone.
Yeah.
Dan Proft is
well, I wasn't going to marry Tim Scott, so I don't know. Like, if you think him being off the market is somehow, that's not. I just wanted to be VP. I don't want him to be my beau.
No, I know, but I remember early on in the campaign, you said, I like this Tim. He's been a bachelor for 58 years.
I like the cut of his jib.
Yep. And you thought that was cool. Like, why? You know, and
I thought that it demonstrated great insight into the human condition.
Exactly.
Yes.
And he even told the Washington Post, he's like, I probably have more time, more energy, and more latitude to do the job, because
that all
wasn't
goes
there.
Away now, doesn't it?
You're darn right it does, sister. Yeah. So they posted pictures of their, you know, he's on his knees, they're on the beach in South Carolina proposing.
Yeah. Get used to that pose.
Stop it.
Mm-hmm. You're marking days off a calendar now, buddy.
So they do just did a little digging, and they participate in Bible study together. She's an interior designer, formerly married with 3 children. I have to check their ages because that could be a lot to handle. But they also, as a hobby, they play pickleball together.
Well, I'll take on the two of them by myself in pickleball. I'm happy to play.
I swear to God, to me, when I saw that, I'm like, obviously, he's for sure the VP.
Yeah. You think he popped the question so he could solidify the VP slot?
Heck yeah.
No.
It takes out of the question. People are like, why hasn't he been married? Well, now you can't say that. You can't question anything about him for being single or being a bachelor for 58 years because, look, he has found love, and they are getting married.
Why? If he would have kept her as a girlfriend, it could be this is the second shorty. You have the first lady and the second shorty.
The second shorty.
It would have been cool.
I bet they're going to have like a shotgun wedding and get married within the few weeks. I don't mean to say shotgun wedding. I mean, like, you know, just go and elope somewhere.
And Trey Gowdy will be both the best man and the maid of honor. if we could, now we've done the View version of Tim
Scott.
Thank
you. Yeah. Thank you. I'd like to help out where I can.
So the issue he brings up with respect to crime, I just want to bring this home because I don't know if people heard about this incident up in Glencoe over the weekend.
Uh-oh, what happened?
Carjacking.
Oh, really?
Here's the text from the family. Isaac was carjacked last night 2 blocks from our house. He was driving home from the Nutria gym at 8 p.m. last night at our house in Glencoe, and his car was hit from behind. He called me, then get out to look at the damage, and was attacked by 5 random guys. Luckily, he was only 2 blocks from our house at Sunset and Skokie Ridge, and I got there quickly. When I arrived, I saw a fight and tackled a huge Mexican guy off of Isaac. It looked like the crew was running back to their SUV, but then 2 of them jumped in his car and stole it. Luckily, they didn't have any weapons or land any damaging punches. He was fighting for his life. They were punching and kneeing him. Isaac fought back and protected himself really well. He only has a couple of small bumps on his head, and his knees and elbows are cut up pretty bad from the fighting. And Isaac is feeling well, but he's in complete shock, and he actually wanted to go back to school the next day, or that afternoon, I guess. I think this happened Friday or Thursday, to tell the insane story. And they got 2 of the guys that were involved, but so
are
that's
they
in
here
Glen-
illegally, or we don't know.
Well, I don't know those details. Okay. But I mean, this is you know what is real now, and what people in the suburbs are confronting, in addition to and including the situation with migrants coming through and maybe making their way onto Chicago, and maybe some of them are sticking around. I mean, Scott's onto something there, and he is, I think, a good point person on this issue, as well as on school choice, for example, to be really focused on the urban-suburban geographic as a partner with Trump, which is one of the reasons I like him. Kevin, Austin, Texas.
I think with Tim Scott was, how would an awful reconcile voting against a black vice presidential campaign and not considering themselves racists? I mean, psychologically, they'd be so conflicted.
Yeah, I don't think. Well, first of all, I mean, that assumes there's some sort of desire for consistency among that segment of America. I don't think there is. I mean, they just turned a blind eye to things that they can't process. Just like, for example, all the residents of Glencoe who were proponents of the Safety Act will sort of turn a blind eye to this, because what's their alternative? To accept the fact they did this to themselves? To accept the fact that the consequences that horrify them are the results of the choices they made? They won't do that.
No, heavens no.
No. So instead they'll just turn that blind eye. That's what's going to happen. Now, something interesting, too, just to get as expansive a coverage as we can here on the POTUS politics. Have you seen this little sort of 11th hour attempt on Trump's standing? This is Nikki Haley, and then the Biden-Harris campaign picked up on it.
Oh, yeah.
Calling into question Trump's mental acuity.
Right.
Right. He's not the only Biden's not the only octogenarian or soon to be octogenarian in the race. And Trump's lost his fastball, and we can't take a chance on Trump. And it's just natural that someone of his age is going to deteriorate in these years as he approaches his 80s. And so. And of course, the zeroing in is on Trump's confusion when he was talking about J6, and he was meaning to implicate Pelosi, and he kept saying Nikki Haley, Nikki Haley.
You know, Nikki Haley. You know, did you know they destroyed all of the information, all of the evidence, everything? Deleted and destroyed all of it. All of it. Because of lots of things. Like Nikki Haley is in charge of security. We offered her 10,000 people, soldiers, National Guard, so whatever they want. They turned it down.
I wasn't in D.C. on January 6th. I had nothing to do with the Capitol. It's things like that. He said multiple times that he ran against President Obama. He didn't run against President Obama. These things happen because guess what? When you're 80, that's what happens. You're just not as sharp as you used to be.
And he also did, too, say, you know, Biden is going to lead us into World War II. He meant to say World War III, but that was just something else that other people picked up.
Well, they put together a compilation, the Biden-Harris ticket. I mean, this is what they do. What you know, I'm rubber and you're glue. This is the basically in one sentence, the Democrats' campaign strategy. I'm rubber and you're glue. You say I'm a senile kleptocrat. I say you're a senile kleptocrat.
Last night, Trump is at a rally.
You know, Nikki Haley.
And he's going on and on, mentioning me multiple times as to why I didn't handle January 6th better.
Nikki Haley is in charge of security. We offered her 10,000 people. They don't want to talk about that.
I wasn't in office then. They're saying he got confused.
You have voter ID to buy a loaf of bread. You have ID to buy a loaf of bread.
What? What is? I'm driving over a road where it's almost all paper. And, you know, you can see paper. I know paper. I know cans.
But all the time now, we see whales washing up on shore because of the wind.
Our veterans don't have cell phones, do they?
He got confused. He got confused and said he was running against Obama. He never ran against Obama.
And we did with Obama. We won an election that everyone said couldn't be won.
Obama wants to, he doesn't want to talk about it.
Well, you mean President Biden. So,
don't put our country at risk like this.
I'm Joe Biden, and I approve this message.
So what do you think? You think they can dull the blade on the perception that 80% of Americans have that Joe Biden is not competent to do the job by saying, well, Trump isn't competent either. And that's enough to say, well, since they're both incompetent, they don't have the mental acuity, I'll stick with the guy who has the least mental acuity. I don't know.
Robert Kennedy Jr.?
But that's not their posture. I mean, yeah, maybe. Well, yeah, maybe. Maybe trying to drive reluctant Trump voters to a third party just so they don't vote for Trump. I mean, maybe that, you know, scrapes a point or two. Maybe, you know, you try and muddy the waters where you have a weakness. And obviously Team Biden has a weakness in Team Biden. And so they're trying to say, well, whatever you say about us, Trump has the same problem.
Well, Trump had a big week. I mean, he was in court three times. He went to his mother-in-law's funeral and then bounced back to New Hampshire. I mean, he's got more stamina and energy than Joe Biden. That would put him out to do what Trump did in 1 week in a month. I mean, he's been gone 27 days. He's been on vacation. Then he'll come back for a day. He's had three public appearances, and that's it. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know. Is he sleeping? What the heck's he doing?
Well, and he stands and delivers at these rallies for an hour, mainly extemporaneously, too. I don't think, you know, right, the missteps, the you know, synapse misfires. You know, sometimes I have a brain hemorrhage when I got a little flop shot over a trap, too. But it doesn't mean I can't make that shot. So I don't think it sells unless there's like real consistent signs of deterioration over time, the way that we've all witnessed with Biden. So
he made a mistake. It was a bad week. You know.
Yeah, I don't think
that campaign ad's effective at all.
No. It'd be actually really interesting to see what Nikki Haley does, assuming she loses New Hampshire, if she immediately folds in, knowing she can't win South Carolina, if she immediately folds in with Trump and helps put this to an end and really consolidate the party, which I think would be in her benefit as well. But we'll see.
She signed the pledge, though. That's what Ron DeSantis in his announcement of suspending his campaign. He signed, signed a pledge to support whoever the GOP nominee is.
Politicians and pledges. We'll see.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, the answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
Sports and politics, and sports and politics, and sports and politics, and
intersection.
Arrogance and ignorance, arrogance, ignorance, and arrogance and ignorance.
Intersection.
Yeah, another installment of sports and politics. Big sports weekend.
Oh, yeah. Did you watch all the games?
I sure did. Obviously, the sporting event that everybody's talking about was Nick Dunlap being the first amateur to win a PGA tournament in 33 years. You want to talk about his 60 on Saturday? Is that what people are mainly talking about, do you think? Golf, tennis, or football? American football.
I'd say start with American football.
All right, American football. Of course, the AFC and NFC championship games next weekend are now set after this weekend's activities. And on Saturday, the Baltimore Ravens took care of business, beating the Texans, C.J. Stroud-led Texans. And John Harbaugh, fresh off of his brother Jim's national championship, fresh off his brother Jim's appearance at the March for Life the prior day, had this to say after his Ravens demolished C.J. Stroud and the Texans. John Harbaugh giving glory where it belongs.
Being here, I just want to start off with this. This is something that was sent to me before the game. It just is meaningful to me, so I'm going to share it with you because I think it's the right thing to do. And it's a verse. Greatness, power, glory, victory, and honor belong to you because everything in heaven and on earth belongs to you. The kingdom belongs to you, Lord. You are the head and the ruler over everything. So there's an amazing spirit on this team, and I just want to kind of give honor and glory where it's due. With that.
That's 1 Chronicles 29:11 if you're scoring at home. It's been an interesting couple of weeks because an entire season because some of the highest profile players and now coaches in the NFL have felt compelled to express their faith, which is a good thing. C.J. Stroud, I just mentioned, of course, a couple of times, including after the Texans' playoff win against Cleveland last weekend, weekend prior to this past one.
And he got interviewed by NBC News.
Once again, this is not the first time he's done it, talked about his faith and how he was asked earlier in the season how he stays so calm, and he basically talked about his faith in God and how he recognizes that he's unworthy unworthy of the grace that God has granted him, but he appreciates it anyway, and he lives to fulfill the talent that God has bestowed upon him. It was wonderful. He expressed his thanks to Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior after the game against the Browns. And, of course, NBC censored that. Right.
They didn't think we'd find out the truth.
Yeah, there was a good
big edit that was made.
Yeah, there's the side-by-side of what he said versus what went out over the airwaves after the live event. You know, editing after the fact was telling. About what you'd expect. about what you'd expect from both the Sports Press Corps, which is an adjunct of the D.C. Political Press Corps, and the outlets they work for, which are largely the same corporate outlets. They're just part of corporate media. But so C.J. Stroud, Jordan Love, who again at the beginning of the season talked about his perspective and his faith and how that informs who he is as a man and who he'll be as a football player. And he blossomed, of course. Really, the Packers should have beat the 49ers. Anyway, so you've got C.J. Stroud, you got Jordan Love, you got John Harbaugh. Boy, I mean, the Sports Press Corps must have felt like they've been Gatorade dunked with holy water. And how uncomfortable is that for them? Jim Harbaugh, I mentioned the day before at the March for Life, was interviewed by a guy named John Root. And this is what he said about being at the March for Life and being a speaker there.
Just have the courage to let the unborn be born. I the testimony of so many here, of yourself, you know, just so thankful and grateful for that. This is a great day for a march. It's a great day for the sanctity of life. And it's football weather.
Yeah.
So let's go.
Yeah, it was so beautiful. And they baptized 70 University of Michigan football players this season.
You know, it's our players and their parents, our coaches, our staff. There's a spiritual mission, you know, to our team. And yeah, I'm inspired by them. You know, you see guys like Blake Corum and so many others. But yeah, it's inspirational. The young players on our team are incredible examples.
Well, 70 players got baptized. They didn't baptize
them.
No,
I'm saying, the season.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's not like you're not getting your NIL money unless you get baptized. Yes.
I just love Jim Harbaugh because this makes me cry every time. He once told his Michigan players and his staff, I don't want to cry, that if you're ever dealing with an unplanned pregnancy, he and his wife would take the baby. Quote, I told them the same thing I tell my kids, boys, the girls, same thing I tell our players, our staff members. I encourage them, if they have a pregnancy that wasn't planned, to go through with it. Let that unborn child be born. And if at that time you don't feel like you can care for it, you don't have the means or wherewithal, then Sarah and I will take that baby.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it's just nice to see this from young athletes as well as from older coaches. It's also, to me, it's a challenge. It's an implicit challenge. You're afraid where you live to stand up to these shrill, p-hat, hysterics, shouting their abortions and behaving like the cretins they are. And you're afraid of them? You're afraid to be called out by them? You're afraid to be criticized? You know who I'm talking to. I'm talking to our listeners' friends who live in their neighborhoods in the leafy suburbs and in the well-heeled neighborhoods in Chicago. So you don't have the courage of a C.J. Stroud or Jordan Love to speak your mind and to, you know, live as an example? Because why? You support these grotesque, cartoonish figures like Jelly Boy and BLM Brandon, especially Jelly Boy in the suburbs, not so much BLM Brandon, but and all of these ghastly, angry, ignorant housewives or frustrated feminists in Elmhurst and River Forest and Glen Ellen, Downers Grove, Wilmette, Glencoe. Shall I go on? And you let them rule the roost? You let them run you over because you don't have the courage to say what you know to be true? Like some 22-year-old, 23-year-old professional athlete? How pathetic are you? How pathetic are your friends who I'm describing? The men in particular. How pathetic are they? That's the great thing about people who provide examples like those we just heard from. It really challenges those who are living a sheepish, cowardly life, doesn't it? On to other sports. Speaking of living a sheepish and cowardly life, by contrast, Dana White. We talked about this a bit last week. Sean Strickland is UFC champion, or at least he was a title holder until this weekend where he lost his title on points. Anyway, in advance of that title fight, Sean Strickland, who is not afraid to speak his piece, and he's not the most eloquent guy in the world, but regardless, that's not really the point. He went after some eunuch from Canada, one of the sports reporters covering UFC from Canada, you know, who voted for Trudeau, and he used that as the basis to lambaste this reporter, appropriately so, as far as I'm concerned. And he said other things that are a bit intemperate in the direction of the LGBTQ2S+++++++++ community. And so Dana White, the founder of UFC, of course, was asked about keeping his fighters on a short leash when it comes to the topics they're allowed to address and how they're allowed to address them. Here's what Dana White said to the reporter who posited that question. And here again, here's the same exact, you're not allowed to say that. You're not allowed to have that view. Here's another case study. Again, not the exact words, but the approach, generally speaking, the attitude. Politicians on the center right could learn something from this. People who believe in peaceful pluralism could learn from something like this. This is how you deal with mousy, illiberal authoritarians.
Dana, I just want to go back. You were talking about, like, you obviously give a long leash to your fighters about, you know, what they can say when they are up there with a UFC microphone and you are getting into territory of homophobia, transphobia. Like, is there...
I don't give anybody a leash.
Well, I'm saying you...
A leash? Free speech. Control what people say? Going to tell people what to believe? Going to tell people... I don't fucking tell any other human being what to say, what to think, and there's no leashes on any of them. What is your question?
I was asking that question. I'll move on, though.
Yeah, probably a good idea. That's ridiculous to say I give somebody a leash. Free speech, brother. People can say whatever they want, and they can believe whatever they want. And I don't think there's any... We had two gay women who fought in the co-main event. They sat on the stage with Sean Strickland. They could give a shit what Sean Strickland thinks or what he says or what his beliefs are or what his opinions are. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. Oh, you can disagree? Oh, you're allowed to disagree. I'm allowed to say something that you don't think should be said aloud? Right. I mean, again... Dana White isn't a constitutional scholar, and he doesn't hold himself out to be, but he has more instincts when it comes to living in a free society than most of the assembled ruling class, including all of your local and state officials in Chicago and Illinois, since I'm speaking to mainly Chicago and Illinois. Because you know what he gets? He gets what Justice Brandeis said, that the bad speech, the cure for speech you don't like, more speech. The First Amendment is not there to protect agreement. It's there to protect dissent, obviously. You wouldn't need a First Amendment. You wouldn't need a restraint on government if everybody agreed on everything, would you? Obviously. But it's not obvious to most of academia. It's not obvious to the D.C. press corps. It's not obvious to most of the occupants of Fortune 500 C-suites, to nonprofits and cultural institutions, museums and operas and theaters. It's not obvious to them, but it's obvious to Dana White. What a comment that is. tennis. Got to get to tennis.
Oh, this is a good one.
Novak Djokovic. Perhaps the best tennis player who ever lived. Still at it. Still winning tournaments. This was, I think it was quadruple match point over the weekend.
Four match points.
Please. In case you didn't hear it, somebody yelled, "Get vaccinated!" Yeah, and he looked at him, and then he did a what, Dan?
He aced the heckler. Yeah, literally aced the heckler. So that's fun. And by the way, a related story. 59-year-old sports reporter Mike Dixon, who despised Djokovic for not getting vaccinated, suddenly died while covering the Australian Open that Djokovic won. He constantly shamed Djokovic for not getting vaccinated. He collapsed and died. The reporter in question, one of the things he wrote, Djokovic could ruin his chances of becoming the GOAT, greatest of all time, by refusing to take the vaccine. It's strange he'll die in for a player so desperate to be loved. And there's all kinds of other things posted on there. Don't know Dixon's cause of death, but, you know, another one of those died suddenlies that leads one to wonder. And why do people wonder with died suddenlies? Particularly, he was 59, but particularly younger. Why do they wonder? Because of how dishonest the COVIDians were, Western governments were, how they tried to say things that weren't true in promotion of the vaccines, how they tried to say things that weren't true or suppress things that were that cast vaccines in a negative light, that expressed some doubts and the potential side effects and harm and so on and so forth. If you were transparent, if you had laid your cards on the table, if you had brought people along, if you hadn't shouted down people who asked questions or said, this isn't for me for these reasons, then you wouldn't have the sort of suspicion and vitriol that exists out there. So that was generated, the response you're seeing, and I don't wish anybody death, so I'm not celebrating this sports writer's death or anything like that, but the response you're seeing is because of the conduct of the COVIDians in the press corps, in government, you know, of course, their allies, and in so many other cultural and civic institutions in the West.
And what Novak sent out a tweet, condolences to Mike Dixon's family. Rest in peace.
Yeah, because
he's
a
class act.
Right, exactly right.
And that guy, according to his family, Mike Dixon was vaccinated and boosted. So
I'm sure he was. He's
castigating
anybody who isn't, including Djokovic. And, of course, in our enlightenment here, Djokovic was banned from coming here to play tennis. Let's not forget.
I know.
And this is what we're talking about.
Dickerson died while in Melbourne. Dixon, covering the Australian Open.
One more, sports and politics. Sports Illustrated's entire staff told their jobs have been eliminated. Sports Illustrated is on the cusp of going the way of the Saturday Evening Post. Is that still around? Authentic Brands Group revoked Sports Illustrated's license to publish because they missed a payment. As a result, the entire staff of the 70-year-old print and online publication notified on Friday their jobs were being eliminated. Now there's like this 60-day grace period or 90-day grace period under the WARN Act notice that has to be given. So there's still the possibility they'll come up with the money or they'll strike some other deal. But what it really speaks to is Sports Illustrated circling the drain, like so many of these other publications. And you know why? Oh, because of the Internet. No. Because of the content. Because the Frank DeFords of the world no longer write at Sports Illustrated. Because Sports Illustrated has men pretending to be women in their swimsuit issue. Because Sports Illustrated you know, again, going with the zeitgeist, has, shall we say, Zoftig women and their Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue. Because there's no body shaming, because you know, that's what it's called, recognizing somebody as heavy versus somebody as slim and what, you know, men consider attractive. That is feeding the patriarchy. Well, guess what? Sports Illustrated stopped feeding the patriarchy, and now their staff isn't going to be able to feed themselves. Mary Kay in Western Springs, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, good morning, Dan and Amy. My daughter works for the Leadership Institute, you know, Morton Blackwell's wonderful. I think it's a great organization. And they bring this gigantic 10-foot radius thing. It's a beach ball. So it's plastic. You take markers and write all over it. They take it to every college campus in Illinois. My daughter does this every week here. And you roll it in the summer. You roll this thing around the campus. And these kids, you give them a marker and you say, you write whatever you want. Some will write happy birthday, grandma, happy anniversary, mom and dad, F Biden, F Trump, anything you want. And she just keeps driving home the three big ones, free guns, free speech. I mean, gun rights, free speech, pro-life. And, you know, those are their, it's a conservative training organization, as you know, Dan. I don't know if everyone out there knows that. And, if you can get those young people to just, I just keep trying so hard, get these people to just understand these very, very basic things. Just like you were talking about the Michigan people, keep it simple. It's just prayer, faith, family, love. I mean, it's God, country. It's just so easy. You can ask for these simple, simple things. Talk to your children, Amy. Talk to the boys. Talk to their boys' friends, everything at the schools. And let's just keep it going, because I am as proud as can be about that my daughter is involved in this organization. She works with the Turning Point reps everywhere. She's going to be one of those kids, I hope, that, you know, makes a big impact.
Very good.
She's a good mom.
Thanks, Dan. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Mary Kay.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Per the big guy's speeches at Valley Forge, at Charleston, sending out his surrogates to reinforce what was said at Valley Forge in Charleston, which is that the choice in November is save our democracy or MAGA dictatorship. And Trump and his supporters and his voters, reluctant or not, you vote for Trump, then you are consorting with seditionists who seek to install a MAGA dictatorship. That's the argument that's being advanced by Biden and company. So stories like this are important, because you can't just ignore the charge they're leveling. You have to address it and then flip it and focus on the record of the incumbent as well. What's going on around us as they're trying to gaslight people into not believing their lying eyes. So this comes to us from Darren Beatty, who's from Revolver News, who got this video, more Jan 6 video, dribbling out from Tom Massey, who's a Republican congressman from Kentucky, of course, libertarian, MIT grad. And it's about a story that came out in the wake of the rioting in Jan 6th and everything that ensued, that there were pipe bombs that had been planted outside the RNC and the DNC. And that the pipe bomb planted outside the DNC was particularly threatening because VP-elect Kamala Harris was in the building at the time the pipe bomb was discovered.
But remember from the outset, you and I, remember when they were saying that there was a pipe bomb found and they had this surveillance video, which we'll get into in detail, but why no arrests were made? and why the area wasn't cleared. Remember back then we thought it was a hoax? I remember talking about it with you on the air, both thinking,
We didn't have
the arrest of the person? And why isn't there more information about this person? And FBI posters, you know, America's Most Wanted up everywhere.
Right. We didn't have the details that we have now. But, yeah, there were a lot of questions that were surrounding it. And, of course, if you have questions that you want answered by the FBI, you're not going to get any answers. No. So here was the reporting at the time, just to take everyone back to the wake of January 6th of 2021. On this specific issue, those pipe bombs allegedly planted outside the DNC and RNC. Here's the reporting at the time, including at the end of this clip, a message from the D.C. field office head of the FBI, Steve D'Antuono, who we've talked about a lot with respect to January 6th, and not in a complimentary fashion.
The FBI releasing new video of the person suspected of planting those pipe bombs the night before the Capitol riot. And the FBI officially confirming those pipe bombs placed at the Democratic and Republican National Committee headquarters could kill.
These pipe bombs were viable devices that could have been detonated, resulting in serious injury or death.
The video offering specific detail on the suspect's movements. By 7:52, the suspect has made it to the DNC headquarters. The suspect sits on a bench and appears to fumble with that backpack. A bomb is later discovered in the bush adjacent to the bench. At 8:14, the same suspect walking down an alley next to the RNC headquarters. A bomb placed there as well before exiting the area, walking past the Capitol Hill Club.
So, number one, the bombs were not live. I mean, they were duds. They were fakes. That's number one. So what Steve D'Antuono said, the head of FBI field office in D.C., that was not true. Darren Beatty went on with Tucker Carlson on his new Twitter program to talk about this video, to compare and contrast it to the reporting at the time and the lack of reporting since that time, which is also something to take note of, and provide additional context to this. This is so he walks through this guy with a backpack who, you heard described there in the news coverage, who goes up to Capitol Police car and parked next to a Secret Service car outside the DNC because that's where Kamala Harris was. And he's the one who apparently tells them that there's this pipe bomb by this park bench within a few feet of where they're parked.
Right. It's right there. You could see it. Yes.
So this is sort of theater of the mind in terms of imagining this. But of course, you can go online and watch the video. But listen to sort of Beatty explain what you see on the video. And then, of course, it prompts all sorts of obvious questions.
What it depicts is the discovery of the DNC bomb at approximately 1:05 p.m. on January 6th. And if you follow the timestamps closely, you can see this guy in a backpack come into frame at around 1:05. What he does is he first approaches a car, which is a Metro PD car, talks to the driver's side in the window for a while, then moves to the other side of the window, and then eventually moves and chats with somebody in a black SUV, which is a Secret Service car, chatting with Secret Service. In fact, we've learned through multiple sources that the Metro PD was part of that Secret Service detail. Why was the Secret Service there? We'll get to that in due course. But the guy finishes talking to the SUV and then leaves the frame. What the individual in the backpack is doing is alerting the Metro PD and the Secret Service of the fact that there is a pipe bomb just feet away that was planted by the park bench outside of the DNC. Now, for those watching this video, and everyone has to watch this video to follow along, the first thing that will strike you as remarkable is just how utterly unconcerned both the Metro PD and the Secret Service are about being informed that there was a pipe bomb literally within feet of them and within feet of their protectee, who was VP-elect Kamala Harris. You'll notice if you watch from approximately 1:07 to 1:09 in the timestamp, utterly lackadaisical, utterly unconcerned. Takes them minutes to even get out of their vehicles, at which point they're just kind of lingering around, uninterested, unconcerned. And then this alone is enough to be a national scandal and blow open this investigation with severity. And that is the Secret Service, the Metro PD, you'll see this, I couldn't believe it when I saw it. They allow a group of children cross the street in the direction of the pipe bomb and allow the children to walk within feet of the park benches where the pipe bomb was planted. The Secret Service agent as well is walking right with the children within feet of this bomb. Then, about a minute later, a Capitol Police officer walks even closer to the bomb, takes a picture of it, gives a thumbs up sign, leaves, after which point the Metro PD car, the Secret Service car leave, and then the video is over.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. So, and then after that, they have one of the, you know, the robot bomb disarmers. Yeah. They send that in, and then
show and tell.
Well, then so the robot to defuse the bomb, but there was nothing to defuse because it was a phony. But I mean, there's also a picture of this pipe bomb sitting next to that bench,
right
behind the bench in this little park area with some shrubs around it. I mean, it couldn't look more like a pipe bomb if it didn't have like the Wile E. Coyote Acme Corporation name on it. I mean,
it's fake.
It's large, though. It's noticeable. So nobody comes upon this until this guy in the hoodie that goes and talks to, I think I said Capitol Police, but D.C. Metro Police and Secret Service waiting outside the DNC. And then, right. So, and if you think it's real, then why are you saying they're taking a picture of it? Why are you not cordoning off the area? Why are you not following any protocols? There's the complete indifference to the fact that this pipe bomb was discovered, and it's discovered within a stone's throw of the door at the DNC, and people milling about in an area that it has a pretty high foot traffic.
Dan, it could have killed Vice President-elect Kamala Harris. Here's the thing. When somebody calls in a fake bomb threat at a high school or at a park district or at a shopping mall, everybody immediately evacuates, even though they know like 99.99999% of the time it's a hoax. But you actually have an object there that looks like a sinister device, and they're walking around like not a big deal, taking pictures, letting kids walk right by it, keeping Kamala Harris and not to mention other employees that are inside the building, letting them continue to work. This is a complete hoax and a cover-up. And well, I think they did it just to make sure, you know, President Trump was never President Trump again, as a backup plan.
Well, something else, too, that Beatty points out is sort of obvious, but so it's kind of like, hey, whatever happened to those pipe bombs, and did they ever get the guy? And why doesn't, this was the point that Beatty made, why doesn't Kamala Harris try to use this to score political points? Why isn't she out there saying, I almost lost? I mean, they're saying everybody was an insurrectionist. They're saying that D.C. almost fell and our nation with it. And this MAGA dictatorship is taking a second run at seizing control of our country and subjugating the American people and so forth. So why isn't Kamala Harris out there saying, I almost lost my life on January 6th. There was a pipe bomb planted right outside the DNC when I was there. This is how serious it was, and so on and so forth. This is a perfect anecdote for the campaign trail for a demagogue like Kamala and her party to use to prosecute Trump and his supporters. So why don't they?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You could text us also at 646-36, type in it, DA, then a quick comment.
Tucker Carlson had a postscript on his interview with Darren Beatty from Revolver News about this video. And a postscript was The Blaze reporting on who this guy with a backpack who talked to D.C. Metro Police and Secret Service in the video to alert them to this pipe bomb that was located just a few feet from them. And again, you see this guy, but you don't see facial features or whatever, but you see the guy talking to these law enforcement officers that were on scene. And the Blaze has identified at least not by name, but who the guy was. Take a listen.
Why did she cover that up? We must ask that question. That does not make any sense.
A quick addendum. Minutes after we recorded this interview, we got an update on the story. According to a report from The Blaze, the man we are talking about with the backpack, the guy who walked up to police outside the DNC on January 6th, 2021 and said, by the way, there's a bomb under that park bench. That man was not a passerby. He wasn't some random person. He was, in fact, a plainclothes officer with Capitol Police. Oh, so he wasn't just anybody. He was someone who worked for them. But they didn't tell us that for 3 years, even though they knew it. And even now, the FBI is not admitting this. The Blaze says they learned that this man was a police officer from congressional staffers. And as of this moment, we do not have that person's name, and authorities haven't weighed in one way or the other. But it's yet more evidence that they are lying about these pipe bombs. Why are they lying? Well, because they were involved in it, obviously.
Well, if they weren't involved in it, then there's a real easy way to clear this up, and that's to explain what we see on the video. Are we going to get the FBI to do that? Are we going to get the Capitol Police to do that? Are we going to get the Department of Justice to do that?
No. They'll all say, oh, it's under investigation.
So.
And why hasn't this person been caught yet?
Caught. I mean, right.
So, because he's an insider.
If that reporting is true. I don't know if it's true. I'm just reporting what's been reported. But these are, like, fair questions to ask. All the coverage in the immediacy of January 6th, no resolution to it, never addressed again, not used by politicians who are using everything related to January 6th to try to win re-election, and no explanation for this video. And we're supposed to just be backed down by people who say, well, if you ask any questions, then a black helicopter conspiracy theorist. You can call me names all you want. Doesn't change the questions that we have and their legitimacy. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, as we discussed earlier, Mike Scott's been reporting. Yesterday, Ron DeSantis ended his presidential bid and endorsed Trump.
It's clear to me that a majority of Republican primary voters want to give Donald Trump another chance. They watch his presidency get stymied by relentless resistance, and they see Democrats using lawfare this day to attack him. Well, I've had disagreements with Donald Trump, such as on the coronavirus pandemic and his elevation of Anthony Fauci. Trump is superior to the current incumbent, Joe Biden. That is clear. I signed a pledge to support the Republican nominee, and I will honor that pledge. He has my endorsement because we can't go back to the old Republican guard of yesteryear, a repackaged form of warmed-over corporatism that Nikki Haley represents. The days of putting Americans last, of kowtowing to large corporations, of caving to woke ideology are over.
And that was after Senator Tim Scott endorsed Trump, and you had a full complement of Trump surrogates on the Sunday talkies, including Sarah Huckabee Sanders over the weekend to try to help push Trump across the finish line tomorrow in New Hampshire. Not to mention Trump himself rallying in Rochester over the weekend and visiting campaign offices and the like. And here's the problem I have with Nikki Haley, for those who want to extend this campaign beyond New Hampshire. And it's not going to, even if Nikki Haley were to somehow pull out a surprise victory. The numbers in South Carolina and beyond are not particularly
formidable.
Not
there for her. Yeah,
And really there's no reason to believe that's going to change, because there's no principles at stake when Nikki Haley talks politics. It's just political positioning. So how can you trust it? I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. This is back before the Iowa caucus. Nikki Haley on a radio station there in Iowa being asked the trans question. Can a man become a woman? Can a man become a woman? Is a man who pretends to be a woman the same thing as a biological woman? That's the question. It's an important one, actually. It's sort of a foundational principle, because all sorts of public policy debates start and move in different directions depending on how you answer that question. Here's how she answered it.
Now, can a man become a woman? There's been a lot that's been talked about when it comes to all of these roles and all of these issues. I strongly believe that we should not allow any gender change surgeries to anyone before the age of 18, period. Kids now can't get a tattoo until they're 18. We shouldn't have them permanently change their body until they're 18, and that includes puberty blockers. That includes any sort of hormones that would do that. After the age of 18, we want to make sure people can live any way they want to live. I don't think government needs to be in control of anybody's life. You go live the way you want to live. You should be free to live the way you want to live. And government and everybody else should stay out of your way. But prior to 18, it is an important time, especially when you're going through your teenage years. That can be confusing. I don't think we should ever in any way have any sort of permanent changes. But after 18, I'm not going to say anything. I think that, you know, you always have to believe in freedom and allowing people to live the life the way they want to live. And if that's how they choose, then, you know, I don't think government should have any say in that.
Mm-hmm. After 18, I'm not going to say anything, that phrase in particular. Well, Jonah Wheeler is a state rep in New Hampshire. He's a Democrat. Mm-hmm. He took to the floor of their legislature to explain his position on legislation in New Hampshire to ban trans surgeries on kids, exactly what Nikki Haley was referencing there in her answer. Here's what Jonah Wheeler had to say as a liberal Democrat self-identified.
And despite the fact that I am a liberal, despite the fact that I believe in non-discrimination for trans people, for gay people, for queer people, and that I will fight until my very last day, until they are recognized as human beings. The question before us is whether or not children under the age of 18 should be able to get these surgeries. And I, despite being a liberal who believes in those human rights, do not think that is the case. And when the question is put before me, and I spoke to people until 11:30 last night, lobbyists, different stakeholders, people with firsthand experience, lived experience, and I've been speaking to people for the last 4 weeks about this bill, the only argument against it being that this opens the door, the amendment specifically opens the door to other bad trans bills. But folks, the slippery slope fallacy I don't think applies here. We're talking about whether or not kids should get these surgeries, and they should not. These are irreversible surgeries. And despite the fact that there are medical exceptions, which are included in this amendment, when people have problems with their genitals that need to be addressed, that should be addressed. But when we're talking about whether or not kids should get these surgeries, I think that goes a bridge too far, and I will not be signing on to that. So
Jonah Wheeler, liberal Democrat, doesn't use the Nikki Haley doesn't use the rhetorical flourishes of a Jonah Wheeler, the, you know, fight to recognize gay and trans people as human beings. That's ridiculous. Of course, they're human beings, and there's no dispute. That's a typical straw man argument of the left. But he's just taking a political position. And he's taking a political position starting from the premise that, yeah, a man can become a woman, just not before the age of 18. So Nikki Haley, I'm not going to say anything about it after the age of 18. I'm not saying that there needs to be laws about these things necessarily, but I think you have a responsibility as a civic leader, as the leader of the country in the free world, to make statements of principle on issues like this, because, for example, if you don't say anything about what should happen after the age of 18, then what do you say about Leah Thomas competing against women at the collegiate level?
And maybe possibly at the Olympic level.
What? Yes. And what do you say about the American Boxing Association allowing men to fight women? There are issues beyond the age of 18 that may not require federal action. That may be the wrong avenue to address these cultural issues. But you have to provide moral clarity if you want to lead. And Nikki Haley doesn't provide moral clarity because she doesn't speak in the parlance of principles. She speaks in the parlance of political positioning on issues. And that's a very different thing. I mean, you can still politically position yourself once you've established what your core principles are. Say, this is the way I'm going to translate my principles into politics. And this is maybe in some instances the incremental approach we're going to have to take to ensure that the law and the culture reflects the norms that I'm discussing as foundational for the way I think about public policy and culture. But she doesn't talk like that because that's not who she is. And she's proved it over and over again, not just on this campaign or during this campaign, but also when she was governor of South Carolina, which is why this is going nowhere. Because she's up against a movement. And even with Trump's promiscuity when it comes to positions on issues past and even sort of in real time, it's still a movement that has a defined why and a how and a what. And Nikki Haley's campaign just doesn't. Neither did Ron DeSantis's. And that's why started really in the pole position in December of 2022 and now didn't even finish the race.
He didn't even make it to New Hampshire.
We're pleased to be joined by State Representative Mike Moffitt. He's a current state rep in New Hampshire. He's a retired professor and Marine Corps officer, also an author and columnist. You can get his musings at Michael Moffitt blog, michaelmoffittblogspot.com, two F's, two T's, michaelmoffittblogspot.com. Representative Moffitt, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, Dan and Amy, haven't talked to you since 2020.
So I know.
It's been a while.
Yeah. Good to see you're still engaged out there, and great to talk to you again. So give us your handle on the landscape. I mean, is there a possibility that Nikki Haley can spring an upset tomorrow?
Yes, Dan and Amy, or Amy and Dan, absolutely. And I know you all track this. Governor Sununu matters, and his endorsement was for Nikki Haley, and he's been working extremely hard, traveling the state with her and for her. So that has mattered. And her climb has been steady, from 2% steadily increasing now into the whatever it is, depending on the poll, 35 or 40%. So it looks like Trump has a double-digit lead in most polls. Some have it closer. But I think it's going to be close. I think it's going to be very interesting and exciting. There's only two of them left. The key thing is independence. Here in New Hampshire, it's an open primary, and independents can vote. Independents breaking strongly for Nikki. Republicans are definitely mostly for Trump at this point. So anyway, should be very interesting and exciting. Tomorrow it is.
And what about Biden supporters? I know he's not on the ballot because they chose South Carolina to be the first primary state, but there's a write-in effort. Can you explain that?
Yeah, there sure is. So Biden in 2020 finished fifth in New Hampshire. He left during the primary day, and left his supporters, flew to South Carolina, made what I think is a Faustian bargain with Jim Clyburn to have a woman of color as his vice president, and also to give first in the nation to South Carolina, which he tried to do. So the DNC has not recognized the Democrat primary here, but our New Hampshire law requires us to go first. So there is a unsanctioned pirate primary, if you will, on the Democrat side. Biden is not on the ballot. A number of other names are Marianne Williamson and also Dean Phillips, congressman from Minnesota. And so to avoid the embarrassment of Biden getting smacked, the establishment Democrats are trying very hard with a write-in campaign to have people write him in. So it'll be interesting, very interesting on that side, too, to see, how well President Biden does with this write-in campaign. We'll find out tomorrow night. But I think it's a shame that the president has decided to take the course that he took.
Do you think that will stick with New Hampshire voters in the general election and Biden and Trump and they'll remember this and that will provide a material benefit to Trump in what's, usually pretty close state when it comes to presidential races?
Sure. And I can tell you guys are political experts from your questions. Yes, it will hurt Biden in New Hampshire, which, Trump lost by 3,000 in 2016, mm-hmm. Very, very close. I think it definitely will hurt Biden here. New Hampshire only has 4 electoral votes, but they matter. New Hampshire is the only state in the Northeast since 1988 to ever go Republican in the general election, and that happened in 2000. And those 4 electoral votes in 2000 is what gave George W. Bush the presidency. So New Hampshire can and has mattered despite its size. And so if Biden loses those 4 electoral votes because he blew off New Hampshire, that could cost him.
What about Robert F. Kennedy Jr.? How is he doing there?
Well, that's interesting, too. He was initially running as a Democrat with extremely powerful name recognition. And then he pulled out of the Democrat side. He's kind of pushed out, pressured out. By the Biden people and folks like that, and other folks didn't care for some of his positions. So he's running as an independent, and I'm not hearing a whole lot about him. He won't be on the ballot because he's not on the Democrat team anymore. So very little about RFK Jr. Happening here at this time.
The Trump indictments, just looking ahead to a general election, the independent-minded New Hampshire voter, the live free or die type, how do they look at the Trump indictments and the prospect that Trump might be convicted of some felonies, maybe a convicted felon running for president on the ballot in November? Do you think they factored that in already and there are just other issues that are motivating the votes of swing voters in New Hampshire general election with a view to the general election, or that those the outcome of those trials will have a significant impact moving those voters one direction or the other?
Yeah, good question, Dan. That perplexes me, honestly. These indictments is 91 federal, four different jurisdictional areas where Trump has a total of 91 felony indictments. That troubles a lot of independents in particular. I'm surprised that it hasn't impacted him more on the Republican side, but I have learned that he's got a core, some call it a cult, a core group of supporters for whom he can do no wrong. As he himself once said, he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and he wouldn't lose much support. So that support perplexes me, but it is real and it is there. But beyond that core, independence, I think we'll see this tomorrow in New Hampshire when Haley gets whatever she gets. She's got a majority from the polls of the majority of independents support Haley. So Trump's legal problems have not impacted that much with his core. But and that's a problem for me as a Republican, seeing him move forward if he does project to be the nominee is – all this legal stuff, I think, is just could be a killer.
Mm. But I mean, it's one thing to vote for Haley in a primary when you have an option and, you're center right or you're leaning center right this cycle and you have a choice. So I'm sending a message. I'm supporting Haley. I prefer to have Haley. when Haley is gone, which will likely be in the not too distant future, then that choice between Trump and Biden. You know, I've talked to enough people, too, that don't like Trump, but they're like, this time around, I just want a Republican to win. I actually don't even care because we just have to get these guys out. The guys that are in now, they have to go starting at the top. And I just wonder if that's an attitude that you're hearing among your friends and colleagues and constituents as well.
Yeah, there is an attitude or perspective that I am hearing from friends, constituents and folks around here. But you mentioned trying to, or the need for Republicans to, beat Biden if Biden makes it to November. That's why a lot of folks were intrigued and still are, including myself, with Nikki Haley, because she, by every poll that does this, matching up Republican candidates to Biden, Nikki did the best by far. Wall Street Journal poll had her beating Biden by 17. She, I think, was and remains the strongest general election candidate that we could put up on the Republican side. Trump and Biden, you know, it's pretty even. It, with all of Trump's problems and baggage, he still is like with two to four points typically ahead of Biden in these polls, and says something about how horrible Biden is perceived. Sure.
Representative Mike Moffitt, he's a state rep in New Hampshire, retired professor and Marine Corps officer, also an author and columnist. You can see Mike's reviews of what's happening in New Hampshire. He's on the ground there. Michael Moffitt, blogspot.blogspot.com. Michael Moffitt, two Fs, two Ts, Michael Moffitt, blogspot.com to follow Mike Moffitt in New Hampshire and the goings on there. Representative Moffitt, thanks again for joining us. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks, Dan and Amy.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon is stepping out on his wealthy leftist friends in Davos, ironically, where they convened last week. We talked about it a bit, you know, in the way that Dimon was essentially, if we're to believe him, take him at face value, suggesting that those who find Trump and Trump voters noxious should be a little bit more charitable because Trump was right about a few things and his supporters like him because he was right about these few important things. And one of the things that Dimon said was, about the thing that is most roiling Americans right now, particularly in urban centers, and that is lawlessness at the border, open border policy of this administration effectively. Here's what Jamie Dimon had to say about that.
Would you take the deal that the Republicans have put on the table, though, which is we want this border immigration policy as we've laid out and then we'll fund the rest? Would you rather take that than neither?
I have not read that deal in total, but I probably would take it. Yeah. We have to control the borders. Yeah. We need more merit-based immigration. We need more seasonal immigration. We need more. DACA have a place here. We need a path to citizenship. If you do not control the borders, you are going to destroy our country. And so I think the people who think that somehow this is okay, so now they're, you know, they're sending the migrants into New York and stuff like that. So all of my super liberal friends, now they realize what a problem is. Did it have to be that? You know, that we realize it. So we want to have a big heart for the world, but we have to
control the border. Mm-hmm. Yeah. For more on this topic and related matters, we're pleased to be joined again by Chris Arnotti. He is a former financial services professional turned writer and photojournalist. Currently, he circumnavigated the country, right, and he put together this book, which is excellent, called Dignity, Seeking Respect in Backrow America. And now he must be working on something more global because he's circumnavigating the globe. Chris Arnotti, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks to you for having me.
So, You know, Jamie Dimon may not be your favorite person. He's not mine either. But what about what he had to say, particularly in the sense trying to middle the issue between his super wealthy leftist friends and the commoners?
I think the there is certainly a disconnect based on class on how you see the issue of immigration and how you see kind of reality of American life, you know, in terms of our cities. You know, if you're wealthy enough, you can really just basically escape the problems that our cities currently have because you don't ever really encounter them. You have, you know, effectively you live in a gated community, dorm in building, let's say, or out in the suburbs in a large estate, you don't generally use public transportation, or you live downtown and, you know, you get everything delivered to you. So you generally do not have to interact the city in a way that most people have to interact in it, which, you know, as anybody in, who has ridden either New York City subways, LA buses, or in Chicago, the elevated knows is in rapid decline.
Yeah, I know you recently were on the subway. This piece that you wrote at Unheard, coming back from Sofia, from Bulgaria, and just sort of the comparison contrast you had with your experience in your experience in that space, public transportation in Bulgaria versus in New York City. I mean, I think that's sort of instructive in terms of what's happening to big city America. Can you describe that?
Yeah, I mean, in this particular case, I wrote about coming back from Bulgaria, but I can do it. You know, I come back into the New York City. I flew into Chicago, coming from Korea a few months ago, and the contrast is just, you know, is jaw dropping. Mm-hmm. You know, Korea, Bulgaria are much poorer than the United States. We're a very wealthy country, and yet the experience of getting from downtown Sofia or downtown Seoul to the airport versus the experience of getting from O'Hare downtown Chicago. And then what happens once you're in downtown is just, it's night and day. You know, I think it's a blue line that goes from O'Hare downtown.
Yes.
Is that the one?
Yep.
How was that?
You know, yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, I ended up making friends cause I'm generally a friendly guy, but you know, you know, I think a lot of other people would have been scared by the situation. You know, you're having people who are basically passed out using it as effectively a mobile homeless shelter. You know, it was filthy. And that's true in LA. That's true in New York City. Not only is it filthy, but the actual, you know, the actual process of getting onto the elevated going downtown is just, it's just so much less efficient. And then once you're downtown, then you have to worry about your safety. I happen not to be someone who worries much about my safety. I'm a pretty large guy who knows how to navigate these spaces, but, you know, God help you if you're a single female. And you just basically want to kind of, you know, take the elevated O'Hare downtown at like 9:30 at night. Mm-hmm. It's just simply dangerous.
Right. And then getting back to the O'Hare airport, what was that experience like?
You know, that took a lot of effort. No. I don't Uber. That's one of my rules. I did a bus to a train because I was actually down further south in Chicago. The entire process, I mean, you know, what I wrote about is that the U.S. just simply doesn't have nice things. Like our cities are gross relative to the rest of the world. And that's really, you know, given how wealthy we are, that's just simply shocking. And you don't really notice it. I mean, I understand a lot of your listeners notice it on a daily basis, but you don't really understand how disgusting it is, how offensive it is until you go somewhere else that is much poorer than us and come back, then you face, you're like, oh, Jesus Christ, like, what are we doing here?
Well, we're right. I mean, it's, you know, these things that have become sort of they've gone viral, I guess, for lack of a better description. The fecal map of San Francisco, this, you know, beautiful city, and this is what residents are dealing with. You can have a $3 or $5 million place, and you're still walking out to homelessness and all of the earmarks of it. New York City, the same thing. Story over the weekend, I think it was in the Post, about human waste in styrofoam cups and parks and, right, and elsewhere. And the interesting thing you write about, too, and I just want you to develop this, is this is what happens in high regulation, low trust regions, cities. And you say, well, the Western, you know, Western Europe or even the developing world, they have a lot of high regulation. They're high regulation societies, too, but they're higher trust societies. Why does that delta on trust, if regulation is constant, matter?
I mean, you know, because like I simply, you know, I tell people, if the government is a sole decider of what is right and wrong, then their job is effectively almost impossible. Right? You have to make assumptions that certain, you can't assume the worst about everybody when you design a product, right? You can't think about what's the worst thing that someone's going to do and then have someone do it. You're not going to build anything if you're always worried about somebody, you know, just coming in and messing shit up. You know, there is a sense of social responsibility to the community that most Europeans or Germans have, or most certainly in Japan, that's the case, where you don't need a policeman to sit around and watch you, you know, because people simply will not behave in a way that is antisocial. You just know, you know, they were raised not to do that. Their family will scold them. Their neighbors will scold them. There is a sense of shame that comes with erratic behavior, antisocial behavior. And in the United States, we have no sense of shame about being, you know, I think we need to shame people for being, you know, basically for being antisocial. Mm. You know, one of the most amazing things in Japan is they have 7-Elevens in Japan. That's their big thing. And in front of their 7-Elevens, they have something called a grab and go. It's literally in front of the 7-Eleven. It's outside, and it's basically two cans of beer and maybe chips. Now, can you imagine if you had bags with two cans of beers and chips called grab and go outside of 7-Elevens in the United States? And they would literally grab and go.
Yeah, and they wouldn't pay.
People do not do that. In these societies, they simply do not do that because they know that's not the proper behavior. And you can't, you know, I understand people say, why don't police just enforce the rules? I agree police should enforce the rules that exist. But you're asking the police, you're putting the police in an almost impossible spot when they have to check people's behavior at every level. Where's the family? You know, where's people's sense of just being a decent citizen tells them not to do these certain things that people do? And we don't have that in the U.S. as to the degree we used to have it when I was younger, or to the degree they have it in other countries.
This is a social contract, and there's a lot of different philosophical versions of it. But it's something that all of the great philosophers understood. This is integral to a stable society, is a social contract that, yes, there will be some enforcement by the state, but it is really mainly meant among what does one citizen owe the other, and that's what you're talking about. That's what's deteriorating.
That's deteriorated in the U.S. to extent. Now, I understand that, you know, there's a version of that will frustrate the right, which says that, you know, part of the problem is people want too much freedom, you know, the freedom to do whatever, to do anything, including aberrant behavior, you know, antisocial behavior. But, you know, it's also much more of a thing on the left, where this idea that you do whatever you want to do. Whatever you want to do is valid. Whatever you want to do is just. Whatever you want to do is moral. You decide your own moral code. And that's the problem in the U.S. is we have a sense of, I can do whatever I want. Let my freak flag fly.
Yeah.
That includes, defecating on the subway, so be it. You know, I mean, and the thing is I happen to have probably to a relative to a lot of your listeners, a lot of empathy with the homeless. I've spent a lot of time working in that community and working with them. We have a mental illness and addiction problem in the United States, and I'm relatively empathetic with those who are experiencing this situation. But at the same time, you cannot. We're doing them a great injustice too by letting them sleep in subways, which is going to guarantee bad interactions. You know, you're talking about people who are also mentally unstable, physically and you know, emotionally in chaos, and you're putting them in tight spaces with lots of strangers. It's just a guarantee that bad things are going to happen. So it's not fair to the homeless to do this, to let them kind of wander anywhere. So it's very frustrating to me, the situation we find ourselves in the United States.
You're describing the Daniel Penny incident, basically.
Yeah, I mean, that's just a situation should have never happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know all the details of that case. I don't want to get into it too much, but that situation should not have happened.
Well, there's something else too. I mean, and you mentioned at the outset we're much wealthier. I mean, what's New York City's GDP as compared to the entire country of Bulgaria? It's got to be a multiple. And so, what do we do? Sort of like what we do with government schools. As piece in Reason magazine last week, $61,000 is the yearly per tent cost of quote unquote safe sleeping villages in San Francisco. $34,000 in Portland, Oregon, almost $30,000 in San Diego, where they have a 400-tent safe sleeping site, and so on and so forth. And so the conversation about homeless or mental health with respect to me, even though I'm a conservative, is sort of like with government schools. I mean, I'm open-minded on the cost if you can tell me this amount of money will produce this result that we all want. But we don't have that in these big urban centers, and actually a lot of suburban areas too. We have just throw more money at it because monies we have, and results is what we lack. But throwing more money at it gets me off the hook that we're doing something, even if that something is not moving the needle in a productive fashion.
I mean, part of the problem also is that certainly in California, New York, this is what goes to the regulation. If you want to build a new building or a new apartment, you just can't. The amount of impact studies you have to do to build anything in the United States is much less. You run into neighborhood associations. You know, I don't want a new building going up four blocks from me because it's going to change my view, that sort of thing. Those one person can hold up, or one interest group can hold up any new product. So in general, we have a problem of a low growth mentality in the U.S. in terms of infrastructure, because we environmentally study impact it to death, so nothing ends up getting built. So that's why when you say Southern California, that's why you look at the cost, building kind of shelters is just absurd because of the bureaucratic red tape. Now, I'll go one level deeper. Even if we had, a lot of people say the problem is we just need more homes, and I agree we should be more pro-growth in terms of building. But I also say, the product, it goes back to the low trust. You can put, people who have these problems, these addictions or mental health, mental illness into a home. That's not going to stop a lot of the erratic behavior. But it's not just confined to the homeless. The idea that you can do whatever you want public spaces goes beyond just people who are living on the streets. It kind of infects a lot of people's mentality that they don't have to behave, in public spaces in a way that works well for the larger community. So, and that's effectively a family thing. Like, why, people need to feel a sense of, like, my parents would be embarrassed if I did that. But a lot of people do not have parents who raise their children in a way that they feel, or have the parents where, the family needs to be
Right. Sorry to
interrupt. When the state is the sole person who tells you what's right and wrong, it's an impossible task.
Yeah, and it becomes, if it used to be, right, don't do anything that you wouldn't want on the 6 o'clock news. But the attitude now is, I don't care if it's on the 6 o'clock news.
No, they want it on the 6 o'clock. They want to go viral.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Our culture is changing.
Chris Arnotti is a writer and photographer. He's currently circumambulating the world. That's a long walk. He's also the author of Dignity, Seeking Respect in Backrow America. Chris Arnotti, thanks so much for joining us again. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's morning answer on AM 560. The answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the 51st annual March for Life happened on Friday. Usually good turnout despite the cold weather.
And the snow, yeah.
And the snow. Uh-huh. And some celebrities out there, too, of sorts, like Jim Harbaugh, coach of the national championship.
Yes, you know.
Winning Michigan Wolverines, of course. And also, too, the signs and, you know, the participants. A buddy of mine, his daughter, was part of the group of Fenwick High School students that went out. And so you see young people out there and their signs, you know, all these right wing extremists, these women haters with these terrible signs like life is a gift.
My sister and nieces normally go out and their friends go out. Not this year, but they'll be back. They make it an annual pilgrimage and they're not shy about it. And that's I respect it. I love it. I think it's great.
Have the spine to defend humankind. Daily Signal had a post with the Heritage Foundation site with like the top 40 or so signs that this reporter saw. And so just going through them, America runs on life. Oh, and so on and so forth. A real feminist chooses life. Oh, these hate mongers. Oh, these barbarians were told by the Planned Parenthood mafia. And the politicians they control, you know, like the entire political ruling class in Chicago and Illinois. Mm-hmm. Take a look at who's actually there. Mainly young people, too, which is encouraging. But, of course, the fight rages on despite the Dobbs decision. And for more on that topic, we're pleased to be joined by Hope Miller. Hope Miller is one of those young people out there. Promoting a culture of life from conception to natural death. She's the president of the group Simply Pro-Life. She's also the granddaughter of pro-life legends Joe and Ann Scheidler. Hope Miller, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So the your experience, I should say, at March for Life, you were out there, yes?
Yes, I was.
So tell us why you were there, what the interactions were like, what you saw.
Yeah, well, you know, since the overturning of Roe, you know, we're trying to find our purpose in continuing marching. And, you know, last year we were all trying to get our ducks in a row. And this year I think it was so evident what we were there for. We were there to unify with other pro-lifers and allow the abortion industry to know that despite the fact that we got, you know, what we wanted, the overturning of Roe v. Wade, it's not good enough, and we need abortion illegal in all cases across the nation. And that was very evident this year that, you know, we're not backing down. We're going to continue to fight. And we were joined by so many pro-lifers, I mean, tens of thousands out there. And, I mean, it was very cold, not quite as cold as Chicago. So it was a summer day for me. But, you know, it was a cold day. We were out there. It was snowing. And you know, we continued to march, and it was incredible.
Did you see any cameras or reporters from the mainstream media? Because I didn't see anything over the weekend. It just amazes me. If this was a pro-abortion march or a pro-choice rally, they would have gotten coverage.
Yeah, that tends to be the case with pro-life rallies or, you know, really anything, is that, you know, the media, no matter the numbers of people, you know, we get out there, they tend to, you know, in some way silence us. And I think that that's pretty, especially when you have something like the March for Life, where you have, you know, nowadays, I think it's the biggest, you know, public display, probably in the past, you know, up there for the past 50 years. And yet we get little to no media coverage. I did see the following day some things on Fox and Friends, but it is not to do with the March for Life. It's to do with another pro-life thing happening in D.C. So, you know, minimal coverage, which I think is really strange.
And so, I mean, your focus at Simply Pro-Life, the group that you're the president of, as I understand it, really is on younger people. You are one of them. And so, you know, where should we understand that this debate is among, you know, the Gen Z generation?
Well, I think one thing I admire about Gen Z is that if they have an opinion, we know it. And, you know, I don't always agree with their opinions, but I think that it's better to feel strongly about something than to kind of be, you know, lenient and not really have a passion. I think that it's better to have a passion than not. But I do think that there is a changing tide in how people are viewing abortion, because now, 50 years into it, we are seeing some crazy statistics and learning more about it and understanding it, and resources are way more accessible than they were. And I think that, you know, our generation is kind of waking up and being like, what is this lie that they're feeding us, especially with feminism? You know, so I think that we're kind of waking up.
I know. Don't you feel like, I mean, at least when I was growing up, and I'm a lot older than you, the Democrats are like, be a feminist. You don't need to have a man. You don't need to have a child to be happy. And now we have really low birth rates in the United States, and they wonder why.
Yeah, no kidding. And I think that that's extremely detrimental. I mean, there is nothing, you know, wrong with a woman wanting to work. I mean, I enjoy work. That's not the question. The question is, you know, what's going to bring you happiness and make you feel empowered? And I mean, I'm not there yet, but I do think that motherhood has got to be one of the most empowering things. I mean, you're raising the next generation of human beings, and we've totally degraded that. I mean, that's crazy. That's how our, you know, world keeps going. It's crazy.
It's the most rewarding job in the world. Dan knows all about it, right?
I've seen it. Yeah, I know it exists. So the I had one. I had a mom. The fight in states that are essentially abortion dumping grounds these days, like Illinois, you know, what do you say to pro-lifers, or conversations you have with pro-lifers, people that are doing great work, like running pro-life pregnancy centers and organizations like that to support women through pregnancy, as well as activist work like you do? What do you say to them in states that seem hopeless, like, well, like Illinois?
Oh, gosh. You know, a lot of things. I think the most important thing is to not give up and to stand your ground and probably be bolder. I mean, you know, abortion rates in Illinois have gone up 50% since the overturning of Roe v. Wade. I mean, we're going to see over 100,000 abortions here in Illinois this next year, maybe even more. And that's crazy. And so, you know, we need to be doing something to stop it. I mean, anything. Even if it's one baby, two babies, you know, we need to be reaching these women, helping them. I mean, people often overlook the woman because they're so focused on the baby. And we need to understand that, you know, this mother is also in crisis. And oftentimes she's also a victim to abortion. And to come at it with empathy and love, and just, you know, I think it's so important that we remain active, but maybe step it up a notch. Because becoming complacent is not an option here in Illinois anymore.
Is there any hope that, like, Gen Z daughters will rebel against their pro-abort mothers in some of those wealthy suburban enclaves around Chicago and other big cities?
You know, I hope so. I mean, I think that the feminist movement is becoming so extreme that women who, you know, grew up with it kind of moderate or, you know, whatever, I think that they were fine with it, and then they've just kind of been roped into what it's become. But I think this younger generation is seeing how extreme it is, especially when we talk about, you know, the transgender issue. I mean, yeah, we have actual men winning Woman of the Year awards. I mean, how insulting that we women aren't even good enough at being women, you know? And so I think that because it's going so far, I think a lot of people are going to start, you know, kind of realizing that this is not good.
Yeah, it's so extreme that men are now teaching women how to be women. Yeah, okay, yeah, that's pretty good. There's an ad campaign in there somewhere. Hope Miller, tell us what Simply Pro-Life does, but too, before we let you go, tell us about your organization.
Yeah, so Simply Pro-Life, the goal is to help people do simple things for the pro-life movement by giving them means and resources. Our goal is to end abortion just one baby step at a time. It's very, very new, less than a year old, and so we're just seeing, you know, where it, you know, we're meant to go with it. But, you know, that's the root cause or, you know, the root purpose.
SimplyProLife.org is the website. Hope Miller is the president. Hope, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
You are amazing. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So at Davos, where our betters convened for the World Economic Forum 2024, there were a couple of skunks at the garden party. We brought to you the newly minted president of Argentina last week, Javier Milei, and the long live freedom, damn it, speech that he gave to the assembled central planners. It was brilliant. It was fun.
Yes.
I mean, it was like Hayek 101, but you know, it's so unusual, especially directed at that audience, that it was a joy to watch. Well, he wasn't the only one. Kevin Roberts, our friend from the Heritage Foundation, he's the president there. He had a message, too, and he put it between some eyes, just like Milei did when Euro wimp talked about how they're convened in Davos to protect liberal small L democracy in Western Europe. Here's what Kevin Roberts and of course expressed their trepidation about a Trump reelection and the MAGA dictatorship that would ensue. Kevin Roberts had this to say:
"It's laughable that you would or anyone would describe Davos as protecting liberal democracy. It's equally
standing up for it.
It's equally laughable to use the word dictatorship at Davos and aim that at President Trump. In fact, I think that's absurd. But I'm going to step aside from that constructive criticism and instead answer your question.
Yep.
And I'm going to be substantive here. President Trump, if he's the next president, for that matter, I think whoever the next conservative president is going to take on the power of the elites, which I mentioned earlier. But the thing that I want to drive home here, the very reason that I'm here at Davos, is to explain to many people in this room and who are watching, with all due respect, nothing personal, but that you're part of the problem. Political elites tell the average people on 3 or 4 or 5 issues that the reality is X, when in fact reality is Y. Take immigration. Elites tell us that open borders and even illegal immigration are okay. The average person tells us in the United States that both rob them of the American way of life. They're right. President Trump will take that on behalf of the average American. Elites also tell us that public safety isn't a problem in big American cities. Just travel to New York or Washington or Dallas, Texas. The average person will tell you that the lack of public safety damages not just the American way of life, but their life. President Trump will take that on. Thirdly, I guess the favorite at the World Economic Forum is climate change. Elites tell us that we have this existential crisis with so-called climate change, so much so that climate alarmism is probably the greatest cause for mental health crisis in the world. The solutions the average person know based on climate change are far worse and more harmful and cost more human lives, especially in Europe during the time that you need heating, than do the problem and the problems themselves. Fourth, two more here, Robin. The fourth, China, the number one adversary, not just to the United States, but to free people on planet Earth. Not only do we at Davos not say that, we give the Chinese Communist Party a platform. Count on President Trump ending that nonsense. And fifth, as we sit here, another supranational organization, the World Health Organization, is discussing foisting gender ideology upon the global south. These are practices that are under review, if not being rejected, by countries in Northern Europe. The new president, especially if it's President Trump, will, as you like to say, trust the science. He will understand the basic biological reality of manhood and womanhood. And do you know why? Not because of retribution, not because he's a dictator, but because he has the power of the American people behind him. And it's connected to Senator Portman's excellent point that in addition to needing a vigorous executive, we look forward to having the popular will inform both the House and Senate in 2025 to pass laws on all of those issues and many others. Ultimately, Robin, I think President Trump, if in fact he wins a second term, is going to be inspired by the wise words of Javier Milei, who said that he was in power not to guide sheep, but to awaken lions. That's what the average American and the average free person on planet Earth wants out of leaders.
Pretty good. Pretty good. And somebody else inadvertently sort of confirmed what Kevin Roberts was saying. This is Emma Tucker. She's the editor-in-chief of The Wall Street Journal, talking about the new reality of the media landscape and the new reality for legacy brands like The New York Times and The Wall Street Journal.
When there's a big news event, a big world event, people still come to the legacy brands. We still have a lot of trust. But I think you only have to go back. I think we have to maintain that trust, and we have to work at maintaining it in a way that we didn't have to do not so long ago. So if you go back really not that long ago, as I say, we owned the news. We were the gatekeepers, and we very much owned the facts as well. If it said it in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, then that was a fact. Nowadays, people can go to all sorts of different sources for the news, and they're much more questioning about what we're saying.
Right. They are for good reason, because of what Kevin Roberts explained, because the D.C. press corps and the left that controls all the cultural and civic institutions in this country continues to try to tell people things that they know to be untrue. The gaslighting, the not believing your lying eyes business on open borders and public safety and the rest of the issues that Kevin Roberts ticked off. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Jed Babin, former United States Deputy Undersecretary of Defense, contributor to the Washington Times and the American Spectator as well. Jed, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning, guys.
So, Kevin Roberts, take whichever part of it you want or the review in total, but I was specifically thinking a comment from you about the specter of the Chinese communists that Roberts raised for a group that I'm talking about the World Economic Forum types that is inclined to genuflect before President Xi and said communists.
Well, I think whatever Mr. Roberts said, and I listened to it pretty closely, I mean, the real fact is that China is an enemy of freedom, and we are unprepared to take it on. And I don't think, and, you know, with all due respect to Mr. Roberts and Mr. Trump, as much as I will vote for him very gladly in November, I don't think he's going to be doing much about China. He might say some things, he might raise some tariffs, but I don't think he's going to address the fundamental questions that we have in dealing with China, such as how to deter it and how to deter it from attacking Taiwan.
How should he be thinking about those questions?
Well, I think Mr. Trump needs to be thinking in realistic terms rather than just thinking he's going to charm Mr. Xi into whatever he wants him to do. I think we have to rebuild a lot of things. Most importantly, we have to build satellite defenses, which we do not have. We do not have the means of defending our satellites, and the Chinese and the Russians and pretty much everybody in the world knows that if we lose our satellites, we're pretty much deaf, dumb, and blind fighting a war. So we need to get those things going. We need to make ballistic missile defenses much stronger, and we need to rebuild. We need to rebuild our militaries, number one, to expunge the wokeness that Biden has injected into them. And quite frankly, it's going to take years and years to do that. We also need to get the people more inclined to join the military. We are now in a very bad place. We do not have enough pilots. We do not have enough sailors. We do not have enough pretty much enough anything. And I saw in the paper this morning that the Army is wanting now to make more accountants and diversity officers out of their infantry officers. So we're going absolutely in the wrong direction. These are a lot of things. I mean, I could go on and on and on, and I don't want to bore you guys, but there's a lot to be done that's not being done. And quite frankly, Mr. Trump didn't do it when he was president either.
Well, our enemies are watching. I mean, they're seeing all of this dye stuff that's infiltrating our military, right?
Sure, absolutely. Well, and that's the problem, Amy. We have so much that we are showing the enemy, so many weaknesses, so many points of vulnerability, that they frankly can't even keep up with them. We have artificial intelligence. Well, not really artificial intelligence yet, but machine learning. We have machine learning impinging on everything from the 2024 election to our ability to defend ourselves. So, you know, there's a lot going on, and ain't nobody keeping up with it.
So if Trump and the Congress were to instigate the sort of rebuilding that you're talking about, the buttressing of defense systems that need to be buttressed, is that enough of a deterrent to give Chinese communists and other expansionist enemies of America, like the Iranians, is that enough to give them pause? I mean, if we can start down that path that you're describing, can we stop some of the unrest, that is the instability that is being instigated by those enemies of America?
No, but we can set a timeline for them. We could set a deadline. You know, we can have, pardon me, we are going to take years and years to rebuild what needs to be rebuilt. But, you know, at least at that point, we would say, you know, in 5 years or 10 years or whatever, you're not going to be able to get away with this stuff anymore. And that sets a timeline for them that, quite frankly, might accelerate things like the attack on Taiwan.
I mean, what do you think that Xi acquiring Taiwan is just a matter of time, or is it still an open question?
Oh, I think it's certainly not anything more than a matter of time. They need to understand that they are ready to do so. They need to want to, you know, they want to do it without, you know, obliterating Taiwan. They want to capture Taiwan, not necessarily intact, but in the means where it can continue to be productive as part of China, not as part of Taiwan. But I think they have a set path, and I predicted, I believe, on this show, that they're going to attack Taiwan before January 2025, and that the only way that would be extended, that deadline, is if Mr. Biden wins re-election, God forbid.
What about Ukraine? I mean, you even have, you know, you've got Senator Slingblade there in Pennsylvania, John Fetterman, now talking about, you know, border security and so forth. And he's become a lightning rod. And it's like, and of course, Republicans, so even John Fetterman gets it. But this is all a predicate for him saying, well, border security, because I want the funding for Ukraine and for Taiwan, which is still the Schumer posture. And so so what about that? How should Trump and, you know, prospectively, and congressional Republicans right now be thinking about this global deal that the Democrats are trying to push, and be thinking about specifically Ukraine and what is to be done in support or not in support of Zelensky between now and November?
Well, to start off with, unless the border policies change, unless Biden reverses himself thoroughly and really closes the border to illegal immigration, I don't think there should be for more aid to Ukraine or more aid to anybody else. I say that advisedly because I'm a very big supporter of Ukraine. I think we need to support them, but Biden does not seem willing to do that without keeping the border open. So I think the Republicans are stuck, and I think it's very much worth a government shutdown in order to, quite frankly, get this border security initiative going.
I agree with that. Let's say that. Just setting that aside for a second. I mean, what is still possible in your view in Ukraine? How should we conceive where Russia and Ukraine is? What our interests at present are, and what we can do in service of those interests, realistically.
Well, our interest is definitely to stop Putin. You know, he will not stop with Ukraine. He will try to go into the NATO countries and the NATO countries are barely able and probably not even able to defend themselves. So we're going to be on the hook for that. We need to be able to defend not Ukraine's borders necessarily, but our borders, as well as defending Ukraine or helping Ukraine defend itself. They're at a huge disadvantage. They have less than 10% of the population of Russia. They have very little capacity to produce military weapons at this point. The Russians have destroyed most of it. I have been advocating for, well, almost 2 years now that we had needed to send fighter aircraft to Ukraine to turn the tide. I think we still need to do that, but we're not doing it. They're, you know, Ukrainian pilots are training on F-16s here and in other places. But it's going to be too late. I don't think Ukraine can last. I think that's a damn shame. I think we need to be doing more. But the Russians are pretty clearly winning in Ukraine, and they're not going to give up. Putin has an ideological bent towards capturing Ukraine. I don't want to go into all the details, but his philosopher, a guy by the name of Alexander Dugin, was basically saying and writing, and Putin believes this, that unless you capture Ukraine first, that talking about reestablishing the greater Russian empire is just a waste of time. So Putin needs to do this. He wants to capture Ukraine, and I think he's going to keep on grinding as long as he's in power.
Let's move over to Israel, because the U.S., Egypt, Qatar, they're putting pressure for a two-state solution, asking Israel to accept a peace plan. What should they do?
Well, I think Israel has already rejected this peace plan because it's a recipe for Israel to lose the war. I mean, basically what they're proposing, and Hamas agrees, is to stop the fighting in the Gaza Strip, gradually withdraw Israeli troops, and somehow, maybe possibly, the Hamas people would release the hostages. And that would leave Hamas in charge of the Gaza Strip. Israel can't do that. They just simply can't. So their best offer, their best advice, my best advice to them would be what they're doing, is ignoring Biden and just keeping on going with the Gaza Strip campaign.
Jed Babin, former United States Deputy Undersecretary of Defense, contributor to the Washington Times and American Spectator. Jed, thanks as always.
Thanks very much, guys.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.